Biggs stood over the cot and looked down fondly at Michael as he slept. Biggs' eldest son, who had died in the trenches at Ypres a year ago, would have been the same age. Michael looked so worn and pale and exhausted that Biggs had to force himself to touch his shoulder and wake him.
"What time is it, Biggs?"
Michael sat up groggily. "It's late, sir, and the sun's shining. But we aren't flying. We're still grounded, sir." Then a strange thing happened. Michael grinned at him, a sort of inane, idiotic grin that Biggs had never seen before. It alarmed him.
"God, Biggs, I feel good."
"I'm glad, sir." Biggs wondered with a pang if it might be fever. "How's our arm, sir?"
"Our arm is marvellous, bloody marvellous, thank you, Biggs."
"I would have let you sleep, but the Major's asking for you, sir. There is something important that he wants to show you."
"What is it?"
"I'm not allowed to say, Mr. Michael. Lord Killigarin's strict instructions."
"Good man, Biggs."
Michael cried without apparent reason and bounded from his cot.
"Never do to keep Lord Killigarin waiting."
Michael burst into the mess and was disappointed to find it empty. He wanted to share his good spirits with somebody, Andrew for preference, but even the mess corporal had deserted his post. The breakfast dishes still cluttered the dining table, and magazines and newspapers lay on the floor where they had obviously been dropped in haste. The adjutant's pipe, with malodorous wisps of smoke still rising from it, lay in one of the ashtrays, proof of how precipitously the mess had been abandoned. Then Michael heard the sound of voices, distant but excited, coming through the open window that overlooked the orchard. He hurried out into the trees. Their full squadron strength was 24 pilots, but after the recent attrition, they were down to 16, including Andrew and Michael. All of them were assembled at the edge of the orchard, and with them were the mechanics and ground staff, the crews from the anti-aircraft batteries that guarded the field, the mess servants and batmen. Every living soul was on the field, and it seemed that all of them were talking at once. They were gathered around an aircraft, parked in the number one position at the head of the orchard. Michael could see only the upper wings of the machine and the cowling of the motor over the heads of the crowd, but he felt a sudden thrill in his blood. He had never seen anything like it before. The nose of the machine was long, giving the impression of great power, and the wings were beautifully raked, yet with the deep dihedral which promised speed, and the control surfaces were full, which implied stability and easy handling. Andrew pushed his way out of the excited throng around the aircraft and hurried to meet Michael, with the amber cigarette holder sticking out of the corner of his mouth at a jaunty angle.
"Hill, the Sleeping Beauty arises like Venus from the waves."
"Andrew, it's the SE-5A at last, isn't it?"
Michael shouted above the uproar, and Andrew seized his arm and dragged him towards it. The crowd opened before them, and Michael came up short and stared at it with awe. At a glance, he could see it was heavier and more robust than even the German Albatross D-3s, and that engine, it was enormous, gargantuan.
200 GGs,
Andrew patted the engine cowling lovingly.
200 horsepower, Michael repeated, bigger than the German Mercedes.
He went forward and stroked the beautifully laminated wood of the propeller as he looked up over the nose at the guns. There was a .303 Lewis gun on a Foster mount set on the top wing, a light, reliable and effective weapon firing over the arc of the propeller, and below it mounted on the fuselage ahead of the cockpit was the heavier Vickers with interrupter gear to fire through the propeller. Two guns. At last they had two guns and an engine powerful enough to carry them into battle. Michael let out the Highland yell that Andrew had taught him, and Andrew unscrewed the cairngorm and sprinkled a few drops of whiskey on the engine housing. "Bless the skite and all who fly in her," he intoned, and then took a swig from the flask before handing it to Michael. "Have you flown her?" Michael demanded, his voice hoarse from the burn of whiskey, and he tossed the flask to the nearest of his brother officers.
"Who the devil do you think brought her up from Arras?" Andrew demanded.
"How does she handle?"
"Just like a young lady I know in Aberdeen. Quick up, quick down, and soft and loving in between." There was a chorus of catcalls and whistles from the assembled pilots, and somebody yelled, "When do we get a chance to fly her, sir?"
"Order of seniority," Andrew told them, and gave Michael a wicked grin. "If only Captain Courtney were fit to fly."
He shook his head in mock sympathy.
"Biggs," shouted Michael, "where is my flying jacket, man?"
"I thought you might want it, sir."
Biggs stepped out of the crowd behind him and opened the jacket for Michael to slide his arms into the sleeves. The mighty Wolseley Viper engine hurled the SE-5A down the narrow muddy runway, and as the tail lifted, Michael had a sweeping view forward over the engine cowling. It was like sitting in a grandstand.
"I'll get Mac to strip off this piddling little windshield," he decided, "and I'll be able to spot any Hun within 100 miles.
He lifted the big machine into the air and grinned as he felt her begin to climb.
"Quick up,"
Andrew had said, and he felt himself pressed down firmly into the seat as he lifted the nose to the horizon, and they went up like a vulture rising in a thermal.
"There's no albatross being built that is going to climb away from us now," he exulted.
And 5,000 feet he levelled out and swept her into a right-hand turn, pulling the turn tighter and tighter still, hauling back hard on the stick to keep the nose up, his starboard wing pointing vertically down at the earth and the blood draining from his brain by the centrifugal force so that his vision turned grey and colourless. Then he whipped her hard over the opposite way and yelled with elation in the buffet of wind and the roar of the huge engine.
"Come on, you bastards!"
He twisted to look back at the German lines. "Come and see what we've got for you now." When he landed, the other pilots surrounded the machine in a clamorous pack.
"What's she like, Mike? How does she climb? Can she turn?"
After standing on the lower wing above them, Michael bunched all his fingers together and then kissed them away toward the sky. That afternoon, Andrew led the squadron in tight formation, still in their shot-riddled, battered and patched old Sopwith Paps, down to the main airfield at Bertangles, and they waited outside number 3 hangar in an impatiently excited group as the big SE-5As were trundled out by the ground crews and parked in a long line abreast on the apron. Through his uncle at divisional headquarters, Andrew had arranged for a photographer to be in attendance. With the new fighters as a backdrop, the squadron pilots formed up around Andrew like a football team. Every one of them was differently dressed, not a single regulation RFC uniform amongst them. On their heads they wore forage caps and peaks and leather helmets, while, as always, Andrew sported his tam o' shanter. Their jackets were naval monkey jackets, or cavalry tunics, or crossover leather flying coats, but every one of them wore the embroidered RFC wings on his breast. The photographer set up his heavy tripod and disappeared under the black cloth, while his assistant stood by with the plates. Only one of the pilots was not included in the group. Hank Johnson was a tough little Texan, not yet 20 years old, the only American on the squadron, who had been a horse tamer, or, as he put it, a bronco buster before the war. He had paid his own passage over the Atlantic to join the Lafayette squadron, and from there had found his way into Andrew's mixed bunch of Scots and Irish and Colonials and other strays that made up No. 21 Squadron RFC. Hank stood behind the tripod, with a thick black Dutch cigar in his mouth, giving bad advice to the harassed photographer.
"Come on, Hank," Michael called him. "We need your lovely mug to give the picture some class."
Hank rubbed his twisted nose, kicked into that shape by one of his broncos, and shook his head.
"None of you old boys ever hear that it's bad luck to have your picture took?"
They booed him, and he waved his cigar at them affably.
"Go ahead," he invited. "But my daddy got himself bit by a rattlesnake the same day he had his picture took for the first time."
"There aren't any rattlesnakes up there in the blue," one of them taunted.
"No," Hank agreed, "but what there is a whole lot worse than a nest of rattlesnakes."
The derisive cries lost their force. They glanced at each other, and one of them made as if to leave the group.
"Smile, please, gentlemen."
The photographer emerged from beneath his black cloth, freezing them, but their smiles were just a shade fixed and sickly as the shutter opened and the images were burned
into silver nitrate for posterity. Quickly, Andrew acted to change the somber mood that held them as they broke up.
"Michael, pick 5, he ordered. "The rest of us will give you 10 minutes start, and you're to try and head us off and make a good interception before we reach Morton."
Michael led his formation of 5 into the classic ambush position, up sun and screened by wisps of cloud, blocking the return route to Morton. Still, Andrew almost gave them the slip. He had taken his group well south and was sneaking in right down on the ground. It would have worked with duller eyes than Michael's, but he picked up the flash of the low sun off the glass of a windshield from 6 miles and fired the red berry flare to signal enemy in sight to his group. Andrew, realizing that they had been spotted, climbed up to meet them, and the two formations came together in a whirl of turning, diving, twisting machines. Michael picked Andrew's SE-5A out of the pack and went for him, and the two of them locked into an intricate aerial duet, pushing the big, powerful machines harder and still harder, seeking their outer limits of speed and endurance, but evenly matched in skill and aircraft. Neither was able to wrest the final advantage, until quite by chance, as Andrew came up on his tail almost into the killing line, Michael kicked on full rudder, without bank, and the SE-5A tail skidded, turning flat, whipping him around with a force that almost dislocated his neck, and he found himself roaring back head-on to Andrew's attack. They flashed past each other, only the lightning reflexes of veteran fighter pilots saving them from collision. And instantly Michael repeated the flat skid turn and was flung violently against the side of the cockpit, striking his partially healed shoulder on the rim so that his vision starred with pain. But he was round in a flash, and he fastened onto Andrew's tail. Andrew twisted desperately, but Michael matched every evasive twist and held him in the ring sight of the Vickers, pressing closer until the spinning boss of his propeller almost touched Andrew's shoulder.
"Ngidla!" Michael howled triumphantly. "I have eaten," the ancient Zulu war cry that King Chaka's warriors had screamed as they put the long silver blade of the assegai into living flesh.
He saw Andrew's face reflected in the rear-view mirror on the cross struts of the wing above his head, and his eyes were wide with dismay and disbelief at that incredible manoeuvre. Andrew fired a green very flare to signal the recall to the squadron and to concede victory to Michael. The squadron was scattered across the sky, but at the recall they reformed on Andrew, and he led them back to Morton. The moment they landed, Andrew sprang from his machine and rushed to Michael, seizing him by both shoulders and shaking him impatiently.
"How did you do that? How the hell did you do that?"
"Quickly," Michael explained.
"It's impossible," Andrew shook his head. "A flat turn? If I hadn't seen it..."
He broke off.
"Come on, let's go and try it again."
Together the two big scout planes roared off the narrow strip and only returned as the last light was fading. Michael and Andrew jumped down from their cockpits and fell on each other, slapping each other on the back and dancing in a circle, so padded by their flying clothes that they looked like a pair of performing bears. Their ground crew stood by with indulgent grins until they sobered a little, and then Mac, the head mechanic, stepped forward and tipped his forage cap.
"Begging your pardon, sir, but that paint job is like my mother-in-law's Sunday go-to-meeting dress, sir. Dull and dirty, and God help us."
The SE-5As were in factory drab, a colour that was intended to make them inconspicuous to the enemy.
"Green," said Andrew.
A few of the pilots on both sides, Germans as well as British, desired the opposite effect. With them it was a matter of pride that their paintwork should be bright enough to advertise their presence to the enemy, a direct challenge.
"Grin," Andrew repeated.
"Bright grin to match my scarf, and don't forget the flying haggis on the nose."
"Yellow, please, Mac," Michael decided.
"Now what made me think you would choose yellow, Mr. Michael?" Mac grinned.
"Oh, Mac, while you're about it, take that awful little windshield offer and tighten up the rigging wires, won't you?"
The old hands all believed that by screwing up the rigging wires and increasing the dihedral angle of the wings, they could put a few knots on their speed.
"I'll see to it," Mac promised.
"Trim her to fly hands off," Michael added.
The aces were all fusspots. Everybody knew that. If the SE-5A flew straight and level with hands off the controls, the pilot could use both hands for the guns.
"Hands off at us, sir," Mac grinned indulgently. "Oh, and Mac, train the guns for 50 yards. Anything else, sir?"
"That'll do for now, Mac," Michael answered his grin.
"But I'll work on it."
"I'm sure you will, sir."
Mac shook his head with resignation.
"She'll be ready by dawn."
"There's a bottle of rum for you if she is," Michael promised.
"And now, my boy," Andrew threw his arm around Michael's shoulders, "how about a drink?"
"I thought you would never offer," Michael said.
The mess was full of excited young men, all eagerly and loudly discussing the new machines.
"Corporal," Lord Killigarin called over their heads to the mess servant. "All drinks tonight will be on my book, please."
And his pilot cheered him delightedly, before turning back to the bar to make the most of the offer. An hour later, when all eyes were glittering feverishly, and the laughter had reached that raucous pitch which Andrew judged to be appropriate, he hammered on the bar for their attention and announced solemnly,
"As Grand Bok Bok, champion of Aberdeen and Great Scotland, not to mention the Outer Hebrides, it behoves me to challenge all comers to a bout of that ancient and honourable sport."
"Behoves, forsooth," Michael cocked a mocking eye at him. "Kindly pick your team, sir."
Michael lost the toss, and his team was required to form the rugger scrum against the wall of the mess, while the mess servants swiftly stowed away all breakables. Then, one at a time, Andrew's lads took a run across the mess and landed with all possible force upon the scrum, endeavouring to collapse it for an outright win. If, however, any part of their anatomy touched the ground in the process, it would have meant an immediate disqualification of their team. Michael's scrum withstood the weight and violence of the onslaught, and finally all 8 of Andrew's men, making sure that not a toe or finger touched the ground, were perched like a troop of monkeys on top of Michael's pyramid. From the top of the pile, Andrew asked the crucial question which would decide glorious victory or ignoble defeat.
"Bok Bok, how many fingers do I hold up?"
His voice, muffled by the weight of bodies above him, Michael guessed.
3.
2.
Andrew claimed victory, and with a dismal groan the scrum deliberately collapsed itself. And, in the ensuing chaos, Michael found Andrew's ear within inches of his mouth.
"I say, do you think I might borrow the motorcycle tonight?" he asked.
Pinned as he was, Andrew could not move his head, but he rolled his eyes towards Michael.
"Going out for a breath of air, my boy, once again?"
And then, when Michael looked sheepish and could find no clever reply, he went on.
"All I have is yours. Go with my blessing, and give the lucky lady my deepest respects, won't you?"